Hello, my name is Chris Snipes, and you are listening to The Melt. More and more, the lines between UFOs, cryptids, and paranormal phenomena are becoming blurred in a way that is hard to ignore. As we begin to think of cryptids as perhaps something more multidimensional than flesh and blood, it simultaneously answers some questions and brings up others. It begs us to question our perceptions having to do with what we think that we know about physics, matter, the likelihood of an afterlife, the creatures that we share this planet with, and the possibility that we actually know less than we previously thought about the big picture and our place in it. Things that we previously thought were bound to the realm of matter may also be entangled with things in other dimensions. Our perceptions of these creatures may even play a role in manifesting them. Today's guest, Linda Godfrey, has written 18 books about these creatures and those who have experienced them. Her name is well-known and respected in cryptid circles. That is, those who study and have experienced them, not the cryptids themselves, to my knowledge. And for good reason. I start the conversation off by asking her what it is that she does and how she got into this field of research.
Sure. There are billions of people who don't know who I am or what I do. I get letters from them all the time saying, I never heard of you until so-and-so, my cousin, my mother, you know, said they saw you on TV. So I never expected to be doing this kind of work. It was never my intention. It's just that I happened to be the person who back in late 1991, early 1992, became aware, I was made aware of the fact that people were reporting what they said looked like a werewolf on this country road outside of Elkhorn in southern Wisconsin. My hometown, I happened to have just started working for a newspaper as a reporter. And so I got this assignment and I thought it was just some silly thing at first. I kind of laughed. And then I realized that there were quite a few witnesses and these had been going on over at least a decade.
Wow.
Later I'd find out it was more than that. So it wasn't just like a little, you know, local one-off hoax. And the people who talked to me about it seemed very sincere. It was a diverse group, men, women, blue collar, white collar, you know, just different, all different aspects. So I didn't think that it was like any one little group that had been collaborating. Hey, let's pretend we're a werewolf, you know.
Sure, sure.
Spread rumors. So I thought at the time that it was not an actual werewolf as people think of them in either the Hollywood style of, you know, Jack Nicholson or any of the famed studio werewolves where they sprout you get to watch them sprout the fur.
Yes.
And their bodies completely change, you know, like Adam for Adam. I didn't think it was that and I still don't. You know, I think there are a number of things, and it may be more than one thing that people are seeing, especially now, 30 years later.
Yeah.
And that seems like an incredible amount of time when I say it. But I still worked at the newspaper for 10 more years. And I was also doing part-time commercial and fine art, and I was teaching art part-time in a couple of schools during that time. But I finally realized that people were not relenting in their interest in it. You know, there'd been a Monster Quest show. Maybe that came a little bit later, but there had been lots of TV shows, one-off, you know, just episode type things. And every time there was one, it would all start again. And so I thought I would write a book and just kind of document everything that happened the way it was when it began, and that just went better than I thought, and I just have never stopped.
That's fantastic. And how many books later?
I have 18 published right now.
Uh-huh. That's incredible.
So, yeah, and they're not all just on that. I've got, for instance, the Barnes & Noble Weird U.S. series has the weird things from all the different states. Mm-hmm. And I was co-editor of Weird Wisconsin and then edited Weird Michigan and then had some follow-ups to those. I've done books in sets for junior high age on different sorts of monsters. And then just kind of my own rolling, as things happened, I'd get reactions, I'd get more sightings and would have to write another book. So it's been kind of interesting. And the last one got a lot of attention. I was surprised. My publisher for the past four books has been Penguin Random House. Mm-hmm. So they're kind of a nice, they have a lot of really great staff and they're a very great platform to work for. But they also get a little bit more attention from serious literary people. I don't know how to put that exactly. Sure. They get a lot more, yeah, they're taken more seriously mm-hmm. in the book world. Yeah, and this last one, which came out in July, called I Know What I Saw, it got a three-quarters page Wall Street Journal article with art and everything, which is really unusual. You know, I counted it a step for cryptozoology, not for myself necessarily.
Yeah, absolutely.
But it was really cool, and there was a pretty good flurry of interest in it, so...
Fantastic. So you went from stumbling upon this topic to being one of the very few go-to people for this topic, right?
Well, you know, I wouldn't want to say very few. There are some really good people writing things right now and a lot more interest in documenting them historically as well as just the, you know, screaming, I saw the monster type of story, uh-huh. which are good. You know, they're good and they're fun, but I get bored after a while with just scary monster stories because, you know, they're just the same elements. There's the human innocent, and then there's the horrible event. And, you know, and what I like is to really look at each story that comes to me in its geological context, in its human artifact context, like, for instance, old religious places that are around it, you know, military installations are very often connected with these things, surprisingly, you know. So to me, it's the associations and the inferences. And then, of course, always the overriding question is, what are these creatures? And I don't think that's been properly solved by any means, by myself or anyone else, really.
Yeah, so it's like, it's just basically a collecting of these people's firsthand experiences, which, you know, kind of in a society, in a culture like ours, where science, the hard sciences are so important, almost like their own religion.
Right.
It's like, you know, it seems like the more firmly rooted that a culture becomes in the hard sciences, the more these experiences get relegated to like the realms of folklore.
I do. That's one thing. And they are, this last book actually dealt with that. They had asked me to write a book that sort of interspersed these reports of encounters from people with their any relationship that I could find to folklore, either ancient myth or current urban legend. And that was interesting to be looking for those associations all the time. And again, not just putting down the story of something that scared someone, you know, but trying to find correlations between, say, a person's sighting of what looks like a tiny Bigfoot to the surprising numbers of human-like but small creatures that are known in folklore around the world. You know, there's the Menehune in the Hawaiian Islands that sounds just like that. And then there's the Native American little people. So it's really an interesting way to look at it. I think my previous book, which was Monsters Among Us, what I did with that one was just kind of online searched for things to put them together. For instance, every encounter that I had in the book that had a fairly good date and good idea of the time and stuff, with everything that's online now, you can go and look up where there have been Bigfoot sightings. I'd look for other creature sightings in the area, look for the moon phase, because that's always thought by many people to have something to do with these creatures. I look for solar flares, UFO sightings nearby. And it was surprising how often I found at least a couple of noteworthy things. So,
well, I mean, after having dug into that, especially its relation to folklore, did you come away from it thinking that maybe a lot of that folklore is more literal than we'd given it credit for?
Yeah, it kind of seems that way, because all of these ancient civilizations had the notion of the therianthrope, or the half-man, half-animal, firmly in hand. They all decorated their temples with it, sometimes they're just artifacts or jewelry, whatever. You can see it everywhere around the world from the earliest beginnings that we know of. It's just, you know, some of the very earliest sculptures are of bird women. I think those were in Katal Hayuk, somewhere near Turkey. I'm not sure exactly offhand. But, I mean, when you've got that continuous repetition of the same thing, no matter where the people are living, no matter what the climate, you know, you've got those kinds of images up in northern Canada and down in South America. And, you know, the styles may be different, but the subject matter is usually the same. And it's always that there's a relationship with humans. It's not like just, oh, I saw one and it was flying away. You can tell, like, the Egyptian hieroglyphs are a good example of how you don't just see the parade of Anubis figures or the ibis. You see them interacting with people. And, you know, like Anubis is weighing the soul that looks like a feather on the scales, or somebody's doing this, or they're going to war. There's always an interaction with people. So we know that there's some close relation that people have, usually to apex predators wherever they live, for some reason. It's not like you see a lot of Mouse King people or, you know, little the chipmunk lords. It's always more like, in North America, it would be wolf representations. It's sure. probably the top one. But you go a little farther south where you don't have so many wolves, and you've got the jaguars and the leopards and mountain lions in Middle Eastern Wisconsin. You've got the great or the big cats. So it's all and with the birds, it's never like the humanoid canary. It's the great 22-foot wingspan thunderbirds, or the things that look like, you know, flying dinosaurs. So that's another thing that's in common, no matter where this civilization is or how far we go back. And that just intrigues me. You know, I may be the only person in the world who's intrigued by that fact, but it seems like it needs to mean something.
Absolutely. And I think that you made an important point in an interview that I heard with you recently, that going back to consistency, if a lot of these reports were fabricated, you'd expect them to be a lot more different from one another, right?
Right, exactly. It's really hard to prove any sort of true group imaging or group thinking where they would have hallucinations and all hallucinate the same thing. You know, it's just, for instance, people like to say, well, if you're drunk on alcohol, you're going to see pink elephants. I've never met a person. I've known a few drunk people in my day, and I've never known anyone to say, oh, no, we're surrounded by pink elephants.
Exactly.
You know, there are a couple places where there are pink elephants in Wisconsin and Michigan, I happen to know. But they're very large fiberglass sculptures, and they don't move. I don't even know why the towns have them. You know, it's
an inside joke or something.
Yeah. So those things intrigue me. And why are people still seeing them? Mm-hmm. You know, if it's some primitive thing filling the God-shaped hole inside every human's soul, you know, with something unusual, you know, why didn't that get satisfied somewhere? Why are we still seeing these creatures? And there is too this element of them interacting. You know, anybody who studies Bigfoot in the field and has really looked at what people do to try and interact with them, they do things like giving trees sometimes. And there's also a camp that says you really should mess with these guys because you don't know what they're thinking if you're leaving, you know, apples in a tree for them or something. So it's not that I'm endorsing that necessarily. I have done it myself. But I lost my train of thought. thinking about those Bigfoots there and they kind of crowd everything else out. But anyway, it's a very complex subject when you get into it. And I know there are psychological components, and there are certain drugs that can induce people to see kind of roughly the same sort of figures. Some of the psychedelic drugs, the mushrooms have produced episodes that seem strangely familiar and similar to one another. But again, almost all of the witnesses, and I feel awkward about it still, but I ask them if they were drinking at the time or if they, you know, regularly take hallucinogenic drugs or anything like that. And these are people who are normally just, they're driving somewhere on vacation out in the boonies, or they're driving on late shift back and forth to work, or it's always some mundane, or they're just walking in the woods with their family or alone. It's always some mundane thing. They all say, no, you know, I was driving or I was this or that. Mm-hmm. So I did have one man who admitted that he said, I was coming home from town. I'd been to the bar, you know, and I was kind of drunk. He said, but I sobered up really fast when I saw that thing jump out of the ditch.
Well, even in the case of hallucinogenic drugs, there's been a lot of research and accounts where people have experienced many of the same things separate of one another, encountering certain sorts of entities or certain kinds of imagery or something like that. So I think I find that really compelling too. Like the drug is sort of opens a gateway to another place, as opposed to those things just being sort of figments of your imagination.
Right. Or it pokes through the filter that we have. That protects us from knowing all these things constantly all the time. And all of a sudden the filter is gone. And, you know, I think what makes me really interested in that idea is that you can watch little children, you know, sitting in their crib, and they'll be smiling at someone and laughing and waving their little hands, and there's nobody there. But, you know, any adult can see it. And then at a certain time it stops. It's like, having the little children having their invisible friends. My husband, who is, he's kind of an outdoorsy engineer, but he had a secret friend when he was like two or three, and he called her Mrs. Hen. And his brother had one and called his Happy. And they could make the little neighborhood kids cry if they wouldn't let them participate in playing with Happy and Mrs. Hen. So
interesting.
They were just dead serious about it. Mm-hmm. So that's another thing. You know, why did they by all means seem to be seeing and interacting with these little entities that have all these different names? One of my youngest son had Uncle Wawa, which we never did figure out what Uncle Baba was. It was probably just as well.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and I think something that points towards the actual existence of these things too is, like you said, the imagery just keeps coming back. Imagery that's been used centuries ago, and has been documented. People are seeing those same things. It's not like that those things are still in our mythologies or in our collective unconscious, at least on the surface. So where are these things coming from? They seem to be absolutely objective entities.
They do. And, you know, it's also, you know, a lot of the, when you look at the ancient civilizations that have been dug up, they each have their own form of writing, form of artwork. You know, you can identify a certain landscape in which the cultures from any one set of people will be. Mm-hmm. But it's not like today where we have trans-global dissemination of our artwork and things that we think of. We've got the internet. It's, you know, people can check out my art from Saudi Arabia. I can go and see what the art is of, you know, any chosen civilization. And so in a way, we're not as pure about our artwork as many of these other. If you know, I'm kind of grappling here because I'm coming up on a different little idea, and it's taking me somewhere else. But what I'm trying to say is just that you would not expect to find so many man/animal formations in these old civilizations where they did not have the means to really travel around the globe or communicate around the globe like
exactly.
We do.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, that makes total sense. Yet they seem to be on some same wavelength.
Yeah, they have the same content, if not the same style.
Absolutely. So, well, okay, and that also can play into perceptions. Like sometimes the way that, you know, the reason maybe that children can see things a lot easier than adults can is because they're open to perceiving things outside of a particular boundary. Whereas as we get older, many of us, I don't count myself in this category, but become more rigid and start thinking that, you know, life is this way and not that way. This is real. That's not real. So not only would they be less apt or likely to pursue or perceive such things, but they're not even going to be looking for those things or evidence of those things in their realities because they don't give it that much time and they don't give it that much bandwidth.
That's a very good point to make. And a lot of people have heard there was a famous experiment that was done where some people were brought to a gym, and I think there were different color balls or people running through with some sort of different thing that the spectators were supposed to look for and count up so that they would be engrossed in looking for, say, and I could be wrong about the exact thing, but they could be engrossed, just for sake of argument, in watching all people with red balls come bouncing through the thing. And right in the middle of it, they had a guy in, I think it was like a gorilla suit,
yeah,
run through the thing.
I've seen that.
And none of them remembered it. It didn't register. None of them said they saw it. And yet there it was on the screen. And so you have to go, wow. And I've likened it to the driving home syndrome, which is where at the end of the day, the work that the average person does has got them pretty tired by the end. And most people, you know, are driving for home. They're not looking for things on the side of the road. They might be looking for deer coming to the ditch, but that's about it. Their eyes are straight ahead. They're watching for other cars. There could be 10 Bigfoot standing next to, you know, just beyond the ditch, and odds are good that nobody would see them.
Yep.
I think that's why it's probably a successful behavior, but so many people, and I've actually experienced this one myself, report driving along and seeing something that looks like a great stump or a Bigfoot statue, one that was, you know, encountered by someone that had a really good look at it, they thought it was a Bigfoot statue in their neighbor's lawn and went and asked the neighbors when they got that Bigfoot statue. And they said, we don't have a Bigfoot statue. And of course, there was nothing there, mm-hmm. you know. And the, I think that this behavior, it would be very sensible to creatures that have learned that where there are a lot of people, just act like they're stock still and nobody will pay any attention to them until they can make their getaway.
Absolutely.
And you'll find that in collection after collection of Bigfoot observation encounter stories.
And yeah, that and also people who have come with things to document, like a video camera or a camera, and they take pictures of, they may take a picture of something completely different, and then not until they go back and look at the photograph or the video do they pick out something that they didn't even see when they were there with it.
Right, that's exactly true. And they're lucky in that case if they do see anything, because they will, these are often the occasions where they'll hear things following them in the brush. They may see footprints, but they won't see the creature. It won't come out into the open. And I think this is because anything that, if these are actually at least half solid reality type of creatures, as they seem to be, since they have evidence that they can leave footprints, they can leave scat prints, they can make horrible noises, growls and moans that feel like they're just, you know, like it's ultrasound. Ultrasound, because they're so deafening. And I think that they probably have very good senses. I think I've read that a bear has like 25,000 times the smelling ability, scenting ability of a human. And that's probably the wrong number. Don't quote me on that.
Sure.
But you know, if anything that's making its living by being out in the woods has to have superior ability to scent what's there, you know, and they probably experience these wooded areas in a whole different way than we do, you know, because we're so limited in that. But if you've got that ability and you see there's a human, you kind of know what that is. And then they've got something that smells like gun oil or electronics covered in plastic. These are foreign smells, and they know that they often end up with a person pointing the gun smelling thing at them, and they are much less likely to show themselves.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, there's something to be said too about, you also draw into your book examples of what we might call contemporary myths. Like one of the things that you bring up is Slender Man, which I'm fascinated with too, because that brings up the idea of, okay, there's this thing that was created online fictitiously, started from fiction, yet people are actually reporting sightings of this thing. So is there a way that maybe the observer can interact with reality on a level of maybe even manifesting some sort of a thought form if enough people put enough time and energy into it?
Yeah, well, you know, some of the latest scientific studies of the brain say that our brains are quantum computers.
Exactly.
And if that is so, you know, and they have any sort of projection ability at all, I've also been studying where I can different Native American medicine people who seem to have the ability to not turn into, but to at least project some large animal or some different sort of creature. And project is the word that I've been kind of looking for. And it seems to be, it's very similar to the tulpa, which is the Tibetan name for a thought form that a person is able to project from their own mind and have it manifest.
Yes.
And at least look real if it isn't. And there's a book about a female elder named, I think it's Gladys Whistling Elk, and the title of the book is a little different, but a woman who was her apprentice was spending some time with her, and they were talking about this transformative ability. And she said, just watch me. And the apprentice watched Ms. Wislyalk, and she said, as she stared in amazement, she saw what looked like a perfectly real bear face come over the woman's face, and then she changed it to another predator and then another right in front of her. And when this went away, she was just sitting there aghast, and she's just like, how did you do this? And the woman said, well, it was a matter of which creature I chose to turn my attention to and to project.
That's fascinating.
Yeah, and I think there's a lot more work to be done in that kind of field by trained psychologists and people whose professional titles I probably wouldn't even recognize. Because I say all the time, you know, hey, man, I'm not a scientist. I'm just a person. I have a degree in art education, and I'm just a person who notices things and likes to correlate them and put things together so they may be more easily noticed by other people, so people can understand there are more things going on. Just because we're standing on this earth doesn't mean we can even begin to think about what all there is. If we see something that seems to be partly in this world and partly in another, that's been going on also for centuries. It's, you know, all through the Christian Bible and through the books of great religions around the world and civilization. It's all, to me, I've come to think of it as sort of a sliding scale, you know, of reality. And the reality could, for me, it could be as simple as atoms that are more clustered more tightly together, and we get hard surfaces like my desk that I can knock on, you know, here on Earth, and all the way to where the atoms of whatever it is are widely dispersed. Same materials, but different layers of them or different concentrations of them. And in the same way, it would be like a dog whistle. Somebody can blow on a dog whistle and we can't hear it. But I can't tell you how many people have said, if I can't see it, hear it, or smell it, no, it doesn't exist.
Yeah.
And the dog whistle, you know that it's having a terrible effect on the dog. You can tell that it's real. You know the mechanism, but you can't hear it, and yet it's there. And that's kind of how I think of this, and it goes all the way from the range where you can hear it to where it's, you know, who knows how high it or what creatures it could reach. That makes a lot more sense, and it's very like the Native American, the typical Native American, and I hasten to say they're not all monolithic in their thoughts on this, but the one that I've heard the most to explain the cosmology of all of this, and it seems to take the best the closest overview of what they all say, is that these creatures are essentially what we call spirit creatures, and they know where the portals or the openings are from one world to the next, and they can, when they want to go back, they can come here and do things like mate, bear their young, and we do see the ones that appear to be, you know, child Bigfoots and pups of the dogmen. But they can operate on a slightly different quantum level or whatever you want to call it than we do. So that when you take an electronic camera and try to take their photograph, and perhaps their whole body is set to be attuned to something a little bit higher on the scale, that's why, to me, that could be an explanation for why we get zilch or very grainy or blurry photos. When we know something's standing there, we take a photograph and it doesn't show up, or it's just a big blob.
Yeah, that makes total sense.
Yeah, and that's the most common Native American, and it's borne out by so much of their art, you know, all of the mounds. Different types of mounds and different types of cultural artwork we have to look at. You know, it all sort of supports that. And I'm sorry, please go ahead.
No. Go finish your thought, please, and I'll jump
in. I was just going to mention it's very much borne out, and I hate to sound too homegrown here, but Southern Wisconsin had one of the most unique things ever. It's just remnants of it are there. But when the first settlers came to Southern Wisconsin and saw all the areas that they thought would just be forest, they realized that a lot of them were kept like parks, and they were normally wherever there were rivers and small lakes, and Southern Wisconsin is just full of those. There would be these raised mounds that could range in size from maybe 10 feet to 150 feet in size or diameter, usually about 3 feet high and like a low platform with very stylized depictions of animals of the region and some unknown ones too. The mountain lion is one. The giant thunderbirds are another. There's still a giant thunderbird one left in Madison, right by the university, in fact. But it was like it was just like a transformed land, what they saw, because there were all these park-like woods and all these depictions, these huge depictions of different animals in context to where they were located. If there was a river running through, you might see three bear sculptures heading down, their faces heading toward the river. The sky creatures would be in opposition to the water creatures and the land creatures. And then they all had these culture stories about the beings that these things were supposed to be depicting. So it really is this, if you can look back in some of the old books that especially show all of these mounds before they were bulldozed, most of them were, unfortunately, you get this picture that there was this very lively cosmology going on, that people were connecting themselves to the animals and connecting the animals to all of the things that mattered to them. It makes a pretty strong case for people trying to learn to project themselves as these creatures and exchange power and all the things that are said to happen in these culture stories that are theirs.
Yeah, and that makes total sense too, because I had a question regarding the fact that sometimes these cryptid sightings, like they act like they're almost real-time screen memories. Like it's like something cloaked as something else. Because often there are situations and encounters where whatever is being seen is not acting like a typical dog or a typical wolf or.
Right.
Isn't there a situation where there were maybe two or three dog-like creatures and they were walking in lockstep together?
Yeah, this is in the I Know What I Saw book, and it's kind of a wild story, but I do really vet these stories as best as I can, you know, and I had several conversations with this man, but this was in a park in, I'm thinking, Ohio or Pennsylvania. I'm not positive at the moment. But he's walking in one of these rubberized kind of tracks, you know, where people can walk and run and not hurt their knees or their hips. And he saw these dogs coming toward him. And I think it was only two dogs, but they were in perfect formation with one another, trotting. They weren't. Normally, if anybody has a dog and you try and walk the dog, you know that your dog first yanks you this direction, then it yanks you the other direction because it's smelling things and it wants to go smell everything. These weren't doing that. They were just marching along, and they looked like real animals. They didn't look like robots or anything, and yet they weren't off chasing anything. And most remarkable to me was the fact that they didn't have leashes on. You know, you don't take dogs. Well, there are dog parks that allow you to have them off the leash. But when you do that, they're normally running around. If they're off the leash, they're not trotting in perfect formation around the track. But, you know, there was a part two of that story. I don't know if you read that, where, and it actually happened before the dogs. where he was out exercising on that same track and saw four men running toward him. And the men were in that sort of lockstep, yes, except they were not seeming to be really, like, they were stumbling and bumbling a little bit. They didn't seem coordinated. Once in a while, one would joggle the other one. And as they came closer, he first noticed that they looked in very good health, like healthy men. They were, you know, well-formed and well-muscled. They looked like they probably had youthful bodies. And as they came near, one of them turned its head and looked at him, and he was shocked because the head was like a 70-year-old man. And they all had very geriatrically advanced heads and young, supple, running bodies that looked like they were kind of trying to run out on a track together for the first time.
Crazy.
And yeah, and he was so shocked by it. And I did notice, I looked up at the time of the printing of the book, there was a Russian scientist who claimed to have been very close to, if he hadn't already tried a human head transplant from a living head to a healthier body. Wow. And that he planned to have one very soon. And his name was known, and obviously he was doing, I don't know how successful his work really was, but he was doing some kind of work toward that end. So it isn't a totally out of the blue idea.
Yeah.
And with what people are doing with genetics nowadays, there's usually, I always believe, just from things I've read and things people tell me, that if you're reading about something as the latest new thing, it's probably been there for at least 5 years and probably many more, is the general rule, yeah, of thumb.
Absolutely.
That I use. So who knows?
Yeah, I mean, it's very possible. Well, and there was also a recurring theme in the book too, is the intensity of some of these creatures' eyes, which, if this were some sort of a projection or some sort of a way of cloaking something else, could make sense in that regard. Like if it's some, I don't know, well, very advanced entity piloting around, or I don't even know what the proper terminology would be, but in another body or projecting another body, there would probably see, it would be a mismatch in the look in the eye and the creature that, right, those eyes were in. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, it, yeah, does. And, you know, when it comes to the upright canines, which I, you know, kind of started out on and have always kept track of the eye shine color, they normally, probably 90%, are reported to have the usual color, which is like a yellow or a yellowish green. And the thing, though, is that even with that normal eye color, people will say, well, it looks straight at me. You know, we had like an eye stare down, and that was the most chilling thing because I'd never had a wild animal do that to me. And when you think about wild animals that are out on their own, you know, you really don't think of it as trying to have a psychological connection. You don't hear somebody, my husband hunts deer every year. Sometimes he'll encounter a bear when he's in a tree, and the bear will look at him and glance away. But the bear never stops and stares at him and sends him a somewhat psychic message, which is what many of these people say, such as like, I could get you if I wanted, or I'm up here, you're down there, don't come near me, don't tell anybody that you saw me, or I'll come and get you. Not in words, people will always say, but just they would get this kind of flash, instant knowledge of what it was trying to convey to them. And that's really unusual.
Yeah.
Walking on hind legs is not a paranormal thing. Mm-hmm. Any mammal can do it. They'll do it if they're motivated or trained or hurt their front paws, whatever, it can happen. But people say that's what the eeriest thing was to them when they had the sighting, was this sense that it was not afraid to look them in the eye. It looked sometimes to them like it felt superior. And there's the remaining 10% that will be a glowing neon red eye shine, which does not. Bears have sort of an orangish, reddish eye shine. Owls have kind of a bright orange, but not too many other things normally have that color of an eye shine. And yet, especially when there are other paranormal things going on, they almost always seem to have that neon red eye shine. And it's sort of a marker or symbol of the creature that, hey, I'm not your ordinary cougar, or I'm not your ordinary whatever animal it is that is standing there.
That's incredible. Is there any sort of relation, or have you done any research, or do people come to you with stories of skinwalkers?
Yeah. That's a name I try not to say.
I said it for you.
Okay. Well, I won't want it to be on you either. Let's just kind of shush that word away.
Okay. Yes.
Another word is skin changers that's used, because a lot of it, they are supposed to be known for their ability to look like animal type creatures. And you will see variances. Most of the time, their reports come from around native population lands or just outside of the native land areas. And there are consistent differences between them and the normal 90% that are running alongside the road and stare you in the eyes. In that they sometimes will have clothing, which the other ones don't. They're usually taller. They have actual shoulders, and their paws look like hands. Evidently, those things don't transform too well. But if you think regular canines don't have shoulders because their front limbs are meant to go straight down and support half their body. And they don't have the same kind of rotor throwing ability that humans do either, but this small percentage just might. So they have some more human-like attributes. They do seem very interested in humans. Sometimes there will be several of them. And they're not always just upside. The skin changers can be goats or bears, bear walkers they'll call them, or other fairly large animals.
Do you think that this is a more of a case of some actual transformation occurring, or another sort of projection?
Well, and it's who are we to tell the transformation from the projection? It's really hard for us to see and know that difference, but it's some type of changing from within the human and within whatever animal it is to allow them to be seen and viewed by others in the corporeal world. How that happens, and there are different theories. There is the Agnes whistling elk. I just projected it, this certain way. And then there are people who believe that there are plant drugs and things that can aid that projection. And then they also have a high ritual in many of these places where there are certain rituals that people are trained almost for life, and that they require them to go out and do sort of heinous things, and they're not appreciated. In the American Southwest, if you know of one of these, you just don't say much about it. It's something that really frightens a lot of people from what I've been able to read.
Interesting. Well, I'm fascinated by the multidimensional aspect of all this. And in an interview, one of the interviews that I listened to, you said, you talked about the possibility that we're actually maybe bringing some of these things into being by observing them.
Yeah, that's another view. And I think that, again, if you go back to the human brain as the quantum computer that can project this semi-reality to us, it's not an idea that's completely out of science. And physicists today are coming closer and closer to finding the real proof. They already believe that there are at least 11 dimensions, whatever dimensions turn out to be.
Yes.
I keep emphasizing that just because there's a door or a door to another dimension doesn't mean that we would fit into that or that it would be any good for us. You go, any Buffy the Vampire Killer fans go back when she and Angel come up across a portal, everybody just jumps in it. Like there's going to be a hot tub and a party and you can have dinner with them and whatever. Usually it's sort of not good, but they're breathing. They're managing to do whatever task they need to do and then hop back into our dimension. It's probably, I would think, not great odds that we're going to find something like that. I could be wrong, but it just, there have been stories about people who have seen something that looked like another world within a big circle in a field. One example is in one of my books. This man stepped in, and there were these two kind of strange-looking men wearing hooded gray robes that seemed to be floating above this otherwise kind of normal-looking plant world, and that looked at each other and then started moving toward him. And he was still close enough. I know he had 1 foot still outside of the portal, managed to hop back to reality. And I've known other people who have witnessed them in the sky. They'll look up and where there should be blue sky. A circle is formed, and they can see trees and, you know, other things up there. So it sounds like there is such a place, but we don't know what it is or how we would really react to it. And I think I've gone far from what you actually asked me about that.
But it's all connected.
Yeah, it is. And so there's one really wild incident that happened that is in my Monsters Among Us book, where a very, very serious Christian family that belonged to a small church in Northern Illinois were sitting in their service one day, and there's a woman in the pew right across from them. They had a U-shaped pew system. And right when there was a moment where the pastor stopped talking, shut his Bible, and was going to step off the platform to join their song type, this woman stood up in the church, howled, and right before them transformed into what looked like a wolf. It was bigger than her. There was no clothing showing. It was just gray fur. And this couple and their two teenage children all saw it at the same time. And there happened to be two ushers up there who saw it. The pastor turned around, sort of horrified, saw it, and quoted some Bible verses at it. And it was subdued before most of the church got to see what that howl was. You know, maybe they were used to, they were getting ready for their song time. Maybe it was their first soprano who had a normal voice like that. I don't know. But this was one where I took my husband three times. We drove to where they lived, met them in another place, discussed the whole thing over and over. They never budged or changed a single bit. They gave me all kinds of information that I was able to check out. Nothing they told me was the slightest bit amiss. And they said it was just like an instant transformation. And soon after that, there was a lot of things that caused some changes to take place. And the church itself is no longer there, physically no longer there. And it was a small congregation. Many of them have passed away, because this was about 15 years ago that it actually happened. Many have passed away. But other things, you know, I was able to check out just for my own peace of mind, that I had done all my due diligence on it. And how do you explain something like that? The children, you know, they tried to tell they weren't really children, they were teenagers. They tried to tell the kids who were like, what was that? What happened? Tried to tell them it was somebody in a Halloween costume that snuck in, or, you know, something like that. And they're like, come on, we saw it. And so what do you do with an encounter like that? You know, I included it. And it does seem to really, if things happen that way, it lends a lot of credence to the woman. What did change back into a woman, by the way, I need to add that, and was kind of helped away from the stage. So by the time she was standing back up and everybody saw her, they just saw another woman. Somebody might have wondered where she went. But it just goes to show that there are things that bear out what sound to us like the wildest theories. And yet there are seemingly normal, nice people. And these people were just salt of the earth, you know, just good folks, you know, that you could tell they were perplexed and still very bothered by it. And how do you explain it?
Well, did the woman have any memory of changing?
From what I understood, actually volunteered to go have some mental therapy. I'm not sure exactly how to put it, but she did deal with this. But I don't know whether she, for sure, she never mentioned it, because I asked the woman. They said, well, she came back to church a few times, and there were some poltergeist activities that happened in the church too that I think kind of more people found out about. and it kind of freaked them out. So there was obviously something going on here, but if she did, I don't think that she talked about it to this group of people that saw her in that phase. I think she was trying to live it down and was probably genuinely frightened by it herself.
Sure. So it just was like, it was more like something that took over her momentarily.
That's how it seemed. Yeah, that's mm-hmm. what they thought, you know, and it just like got to a point where it overpowered her and you could say projected this other image of her on the people in the church so that they saw this other thing all together at the same time. And there were four members of the family and at least two ushers and the pastor. So at least seven people saw it.
Wow. That sounds terrifying.
Yeah, I think it's one of the most haunting, you know, especially with the number of witnesses, and it was daylight and close range, you know, it wasn't something happening up on the hill at sunset, you know, it was right there in your face, and they had to deal with it.
Wow. Jeez. Well, I know we're closing in on an hour here, so if I could just ask you maybe just a couple more questions, and then I will let you go about your day. You mentioned that one of the ways that you study these things or you categorize them is by region. Have you come across any recurring patterns? Like, do these things seem to be, these experiences and encounters, are they more concentrated near, for instance, like national or state parks or military bases? Or is there any consistency to that?
Yeah, there is. I noticed quite early on that military installations of any kind seem to be very often connected with sightings of these different human-like large predator creatures. I keep thinking of different names for them, you know, because they have sort of so many different representations in my mind, but that's sort of essentially what they are. But then there are also many that seem attracted to bodies of water. I think perhaps that's why there are so many sightings in the Great Lakes area, because not only are these huge bodies of water very handy nearby, but then they produce rivers and streams that project out from them in the lake. So you end up with just a really well-watered area. And for instance, mountain lions are known as river cats because they like to do their hunting and predation around rivers. And you'll find wolves wherever there are lakes. Any type of creature that eats a lot of meat or protein definitely needs a lot of water to help them digest it. So, and also that's where the prey is going. The prey is going down to the water hole. So, you know, I can talk about this in more fanciful terms, or I can put my old reporter's hat on and say, well, yeah, but they needed water to drink. Why wouldn't they be by the water? And then you do find out when you look at the map that there are many more sightings wherever you have these well-watered places. So that's one. And then the military installations, I've discovered more and more of those. I have some of those in the Monsters Among Us book. And then it gets kind of wacky. They have different forms of werewolves at a lot of these leftover base areas, especially in Germany and France and the UK. And sometimes they're the same sort of animals in these other countries, but most of the time they're referred to as werewolves, and they have those glowing red eyes, kind of like the England's Black Shuck, which is a famous old folk black dog that is supposed to appear during deaths or that sort of thing. So there's all that, and then there's also wherever you find, especially ancient burial grounds and or places of worship, which are very often one and the same thing, that you'll find concentrations of these types of sightings.
Interesting. Which lends it more, I mean, I know what I was going to get into for the last question is that it seems like, say, 25 years ago, it was more easy to classify, to have a clean boundary in between, say, UFOs, paranormal, cryptids. But as time goes on, and as all these different experiences and people talking about their encounters come in, it seems like those lines are getting more and more blurred. Are you finding that in your research too?
Yeah, I think that's true. And the late great John Keel called them window areas, where if you've got one coming out and you stay around and observe and watch, you're probably going to see others. And for instance, he studied the Point Pleasant area in West Virginia when the Mothman was prevalent in the mid 60s mm-hmm. and into the 70s. And he first was drawn because there were many UFO sightings. And then, of course, the Mothman appeared, and then Men in Black, and, you know, a few other things. So, you know, he quickly deciphered that this was these types of appearances seem to be related to the same general areas and in the same time frames. And we have a flap of one, you'll have a flap of sightings of the other, you know. And my motto is no one can study just one cryptid, you know, kind of like a potato chip.
Yes.
Certainly. You know, because there are people who really just say, well, I only studied the Dogman, or I only, well, really, if you were out in the woods and you saw a Dogman and there was a Bigfoot too, would you ignore having seen the Bigfoot? It's like, how can, I'm not sure how you can quite separate them entirely.
Exactly.
Yeah. So, and they do have so many things in common. And I mentioned earlier that I had, in my next to last book, I was looking up categories of UFOs that had been seen near or around certain, you know, really great upright cryptid sightings. And there were, you know, I was surprised. And there are UFO stories. There's one great UFO story from northern Wisconsin where a farmer was driving home and saw this saucer-shaped object sitting next to the road and looked in. There was kind of like a bubble-type hatch on the top, and he could look in and see there was a furry-faced creature with its hands sort of up and extended toward him. And, yeah, this is up in a town called Frederick. And he was flabbergasted, and he went home. And the next day it was gone, but there were still tracks there or something like that. Wow. So, yeah, so you have a lot of different elements there.
That's amazing. And they're often in the same, in the same areas and around the same times too. They're often seen together, if not together, then sometimes, you know, not too in the same sort of time period.
Right. And probably sunset and dawn are the most usual times when these things are just into the early hours of the night. And there's a word I'll throw at you, liminality, mm-hmm. which again seems to be a commonality. Liminality just means on the outskirts of things. And that's why you'll find things that are on the edge of campgrounds, on bridges. If you're in the center of a bridge, you're neither on one side nor the other. You're just sort of in the middle. I'm starting to get more sightings on the outskirts of towns. I had just last March, I had a great black cougar or mountain lion or panther or whatever you want to call it, sighting just on the edge of a town where a man had his home barber shop. And he watched this thing. It was about sunset, I believe, but he could still see it very clearly. Watched maybe 50 feet from him, went through his yard, and then passed on through some trees and was headed in the general direction of downtown. But he was only seen in the liminal area, the outskirts. And that's something else that I've been kind of thinking about and trying to tie that down to something more understandable.
Yeah, and even another layer of that would be sometimes it seems, for instance, at least in the case of ghosts, maybe with cryptids too, that it's easier to catch those at the corner of your eye, so at the outskirts of your vision.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, definitely something that you hear.
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely. Well, it's such fascinating stuff, and your research is so comprehensive, and I can't wait to read more of your books. I just started with the most recent one, I Know What I Saw, and I highly recommend it to anybody who's listening. And also I want to mention the documentary too. You just recently made a documentary with your son, right?
Right. My son and my husband as producer, mm-hmm. he was a great driver and he's a numbers guy, which neither my son nor I are. So he did real well and is still working hard on the books and all the background stuff. But my son has a degree in film and art from the School of the Art Institute of Chicago. And I had become aware of these, the return of so many mountain lions to the United States. And there's a place in Wisconsin, central Wisconsin, near a whole bunch of crazy geological formations and things, where one man has gathered at least well over 150 reports in the past several decades. Wow. Of these creatures. And the weird thing is that over half of them are black, and black mountain lions are not supposed to exist. It's supposed to be genetically impossible, although I'm not sure exactly why. But that begs the question, what are they then? And the answers range from black jaguars and leopards, which are way up north from their usual ranges. Native Americans believe that these are spirit cats, the black ones, and that they have a role to play in, you know, the coming changing of the world or whatever their culture stories are. And so it seemed to me, and nobody wanted to touch the story. I had talked to several producers that were out here to do another. There have been very, very many documentaries done on the Beast of Bray Road, the upright canine.
Yes.
And I said, you know, we've got this present new mystery, and nobody seemed interested in it. And I happened to have an uncle, a great uncle who, he's my first uncle, I guess. My only uncle, anyway, who passed away and left me and each of my siblings a modest sum of money that we could do a little something with. And I realized that with my son's abilities and some of my connections and my husband's talents, that we could make our own film, just a simple but hopefully complete documentary on this. And so we just are putting the final finishing tiny touches on it, and it's going to have its first screening at because it's an unusual title. You can tell I've been talking for an hour or two. It's the Midwest Weird Fest Film Festival.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, and it was kind of a nice coming back, circling around sort of thing, because the man who developed it and started it in Eau Claire was originally attracted by those first books I did on Weird Wisconsin and Weird Michigan.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, I was known as the Weird Writer. And then, you know, he has this, I think it's the fourth year now of this. So
cool.
So we'll be doing that. But yeah, and I learned a lot. And again, just this amazing group of people. We even had a woman who worked for the Florida Panther Project with two PhDs and was a direct assistant to the creator of the project, who had seen what she called black panthers. And panthers supposed to be a no-no word with they're not supposed to exist as panthers either. Mm-hmm. But she had seen them and interacted with them in Florida, and somehow happened to move to Hillsborough, this little town, for her retirement, and started seeing them along with most of her neighbors out on her ranch land.
Wow.
So yeah, so it's got just an amazing corroboration by people. And I don't know if we'll ever do another one, but I was really glad to help these people get a voice, because that's where the title of this book came from. I Know What I Saw. People were continually saying, I saw this, it was daylight, you know, I had a good look at it. I know it was like a panther or a mountain lion, but I went to the authorities and they said, there's no such thing, you didn't see it. You know, and I don't mean to try and guide anybody's beliefs one way or the other, but I think that when you've got such an amazing number of voices, all having had this experience and wanting to see it, that they should be heard. And that was my aim, is to have people's voices heard on this amazing topic.
And I think you have been very successful in that. Speaking of which, where is there going to be any place to watch the documentary eventually online?
We're right now actually working on loading it to Amazon.
Great.
Streaming Amazon, and there will be another streaming platform. And then you can go to Facebook, and there's it's just called Return to Wildcat Mountain. And you can look up some things on there. I'm in the process of placing it at my blog, which is lindagodfrey.com. And you can just get a good fast look at the 2.5 minute trailer on YouTube. Just go to YouTube and type in Return to Wildcat Mountain, and it'll show you the trailer. And you can get a good sense of what it's like from that. Although the finished film is, I think, about 48 to 50 minutes. So there's a lot in there, and we had some great Native representation of some of those culture stories I was mentioning.
Fantastic. I can't wait to watch it. So if people want to get a hold of you, if they have had an encounter or something that they would like to share with you, they can also get a hold of you through lindagodfrey.com.
Right. And there's a tab that says about, bios and whatever, and there's a box there that you can just send me a message in the box. It'll be great.
Fantastic. Well, Linda, thank you so much for having a conversation with me. And do you have another book in the works, or what, any projects besides the documentary going on?
There are a couple I've been tossing around with my agent and trying to figure out which one I really want to do or have the best handle on or the best information. So cool. It took me 3 years to get this last one out of my head and into the hands of people. It was a lot of work, and I had things going on in my personal life with my uncle passing and my mother and other things that were happening at the time. So sure. I'm taking a short break, but I do expect there will be, I hope, at least one more that I can get done.
Fantastic. Well, I look forward to having you on to talk about that one.
Well, thank you so much, and thank you for having me for this one. It was a pleasure, really.
Absolutely. Likewise. And until the next time we talk, enjoy it, keep up the good work, and you are much appreciated in your field.
Well, thank you so much, and thanks to all of your listeners, too. I appreciate anyone who buys a book or even just listens. I'm really grateful.
Fantastic. Thank you again, Linda.
You're welcome.
All right. Take care.
You too.
Well, that was a great conversation. It really was not by design that I have had so many cryptid shows recently, kind of beginning with Dr. C.S. Matthews talking about her book, what is it? Mysterious Beauty, Living with the Paranormal in the Hudson Valley, which was an excellent book and an excellent episode. That sort of led into, because this next person, Gail Beatty, is somebody that appeared in Dr. C.S. Matthews' book. So that's how she got on my radar. And again, another fantastic cryptid episode. Not that Dr. C.S. Matthews' episode was strictly cryptids, but there was a lot of that interwoven and interspersed in the supernatural miasma that is the Hudson Valley. And then leading to the third in this flap of cryptid episodes is Linda Godfrey, very accomplished researcher, somebody who's been doing a lot of thankless work for a long time, and she's given a lot of people a good forum and a place where they can talk about these experiences that they probably have a difficult time talking with most of their friends and family about. So, yay, Linda. I highly suggest that you visit her blog. And I have not yet watched the documentary, but I fully plan to as soon as I track it down, which should be fairly easy. Anyway, thank you so much for listening. If you like what I do here and you would like to hear more of it, I have a Patreon page, surprise, surprise, www.patreon.com/themeltpodcast. You can donate as little as $1 a month, and I believe that you can go there and do a custom donation or maybe a one-time donation of any amount that you want. But for as low as $1 a month, you can get access to video versions of interviews, and I swear that there is going to be a little video version of a presentation that Dr. C.S. Matthews, otherwise known as Professor Wham, did in regards to her book Mysterious Beauty, not too far away from me. So I filmed it and I got the slides, and I need to edit them in there, but I just haven't gotten around to doing that yet. So things like that will be there. I want to put some mini documentaries that I have in mind for the future on there too. So, but really, I would just like you, even if there's no goodies just yet, or the pile of treasures isn't that high, maybe just because you dig what I do and, you know, most likely you're not going to miss a dollar out of your bank account a month. There have been times in my life where I definitely would have missed that. Fortunately, I'm not in one of those times right now, and I am very grateful for that. But I really would like to do more with this podcast, including, first and foremost, putting out more of them. As it is now, I'm putting them out every other week, and I'll see how that goes. I've been getting a lot of good response, but always feel free to subscribe and or rate my podcast, give a review on iTunes, on Stitcher, on Spotify, Google Play, and I'm sure others that I'm not thinking of right now. And spreading the word really is something that's very simple to do, but extremely effective. That is how stuff gets out in this day and age on the internet, where we can sort of easily forward things to people that might be interested in such things or might have something to contribute. And I'm always open for guests' suggestions too. Guest suggestions, rather. And I still would love to hear recorded versions of your stories about your experiences with things that we, the kinds of things that I talk about on The Melt. And you can send those to themeltpodcast@gmail.com. Thank you so much for listening. As always, fantastic stuff coming around the corner. I am excited to put it out and turn you on to it. So take care, and until next time.